I like your beer, Rick.
Thank you.
I haven't had any yet.
Welcome to Big Foamy Head. Here we are at the World Brewers Forum, and
here we are.
Yeah, this is the Croc Cake Ran Out Club as an annual event at the Great American Beer Fest, and we're joined with a very special or very important person, James Spencer. How are you doing?
Am I special or important? Which is
you're always
you're
special.
Especially, you're especially.
You're
we're,
special. And
we're all winners person. At Big Foamy Head.
Yeah.
So it was a surprise to see you come down the escalator. We were thrilled to death. I was, personally. I was like, hey. And you're here with Andy Sparks, and you guys have been...
I think he's asleep on the floor somewhere.
Yeah, he took off.
Doing some bus tours, right?
I've got a stool. I'm going to sit on my stool.
So we're cubbied off into the corner. There's speakers going on right now, and they're doing a raffle for some events. It supports... a charitable cause, Children's Hospital, and also funds our club for the year, so we don't have any dues, but we don't advertise that too much.
So the Croc is Keg Ran Out Club.
Keg Ran Out. They were trying to name the club, and guess what happened while they were naming the club? Keg Ran Out.
Thus the name. And so there's a couple.
So you don't want to say the Croc Club.
Couple of speakers here too, right?
Right. We've got Steve Presley, who's the senior assistant brewmaster at Anheuser-Busch in Fort Collins, Colorado. Tony Simmons, president and head brewer at Pagosa Brewing Company, Pagosa Springs, Colorado. And we're followed up with the big leaguer, Greg Cook, CEO and co-founder of Stone Brewing Company.
Yeah. And he's about to come up?
He comes on about 10:15.
Yeah, okay. On the 15s. And yep. Jim Fixari brought us in here and said...
Right,
said, you guys go sit way over there in the corner?
No, he didn't. He was trying to be gracious and putting us someplace, but apparently we showed up late. So and, we were at the Great American Beer Festival.
And we've enjoyed our usual host of technical problems. Right?
Indeed.
And, yeah, it's all great minds got together and figured it out.
Yeah. We're all sharing the one wooden microphone.
It took me an hour and a half to carve it out of that stick over there.
Yeah. So, James, tell us about your bus tour.
Well, I didn't go on the bus tour.
Oh, I thought you did.
No.
You drove up to Fort Collins?
Yeah. Andy did more drinking than I did because I signed up for the rental car. So we went up to Fort Collins and had some samples at O'Dell's, not O'Dell's.
Doug O'Dell.
That's a different bus tour.
Yeah.
That's a designated driver tour.
Drink up.
I have a funny O'Dell story later if you want that. But we went to O'Dell's, had some tasty samples up there, and then went over to New Belgium and sampled some beers over there, and then drove down to Boulder and dropped by Redstone Meadery and Avery, and wound up at the Brett Pack beer dinner last night.
Yeah, we incredible. Did that last year, and we were so tempted. So you said it came out really good this year?
Oh, yeah. It was excellent. So
yeah, I think we had 3 of 5 brewers, and you guys had the full Brett
full
Pack.
Monty,
yeah,
as it were.
Well, how'd you like the mead?
Oh, it's always great. For the first time, we tried the hopped mead.
A hopped mead?
Yeah. Wow.
What do they call it? The nectar of the hops?
Really?
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it was good. It wasn't as hopped as I thought it would be, but very interesting. You know, the hops kind of sharpen up the sweetness a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And just dry hopping with hops that are traditionally used for, you know, IPAs and such.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously not as hoppy as an IPA, or it'd be way out of whack.
Yeah.
But good stuff, and we tried their sizer and wound up going home with bottles of it. So, overall, good trip. The unfortunate consequence was that, you know, we were so tired today that I've maybe had 2 beers the whole day. So,
really?
I'm doing my penance today.
Well, I hope you get an opportunity to enjoy a few here. I know that when you were here for the National Homebrewers Conference, you and Steve spent quite a bit at the Redstone Meadery.
Yeah.
You came back with the real fancy bottles going, ooh, look at these bottles.
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah. Well, we didn't spend quite as much. but we did spend some money. But, you know, that stuff lasts forever because you don't, it's not like you pour a full 12 ounce of fancy stuff.
Yeah. We did mead two shows. Last show.
That's the last show we posted. So
yeah,
we did the not beer show.
Yeah, and had a little of this, a little of that. Rick's favorite, was it 1855 or 1866?
Oh, there was a home brewed mead that
somebody's
I was stewarding the event, so that we walked away with a couple samples. You know, the bottles that were left over. But there was one from Texas. No, it was Zachman. He had a 25% mead. It was really remarkable because
Melomel.
And you didn't know the alcohol volume was so high. You could drink it like cherry soda. And
we were a little loopy by the end of that show.
Dangerous stuff, but very good.
A little loopy.
And then tomorrow is the mead event. What is it? I can't remember the name of it. Is it the Back to Your Roots thing that David Myers always hosts?
Yeah.
It's going to happen tomorrow from 3 to 5 maybe.
Well, once again,
at the GABF.
I think it's in the convention center.
Once again, Big Foamy Head did not go for our press passes in time in a timely manner. So,
well, shame on you.
I know. We're slackers.
We would have to work.
That's right.
But you wouldn't have to work.
Yeah,
I mean,
guess so.
In order not to feel guilty, you might have had to work.
Yeah.
But
Andy is walking away with swag. So.
What's he got? He's got T-shirts, glasses.
He's a winner, not a loser.
look at you.
Well, thanks for coming to the losers' table.
Two of the lottery tickets, I hit on two of them. So,
which kind of giveaways to get?
Got a couple glasses. I got a foam gauge so that I can test my beers when I go to the bar and make sure they haven't cheated me. And I got a hat from the AHA and a T-shirt. I'm not sure who the T-shirt's from. And then a bottle of Stone... Stone Ruination IPA curry mustard grilling sauce.
Very nice.
Good. I hear some hooting and hollering in there, so it must have been kind of fun.
Yeah.
Very nice.
We thought you were asleep on the floor somewhere.
So I think we're going to have several small segments, and we may as well just wrap this one up.
All right.
Line up our next guest. Thanks, James, for joining us. And
hey,
I hope you get rested up so you can enjoy some beer tomorrow.
Oh,
yeah,
definitely.
You've only got three more sessions to try and catch up. So. Bull & Bush has some excellent offerings. Highly recommended.
They were all good, weren't they?
Yeah. Well,
so
we'll have more
more
details for that.
What was the oil?
Royal Oil.
Man.
Man beer and something in
the
liquid.
The Legend of the Liquid Brain.
That was good, too.
And they were serving Cheese Whiz on crackers.
Yeah, yeah. You can't get any high class. They had like little butler outfits serving Ritz crackers and Cheese Whiz.
any food product that comes with a propellant is good enough for me.
It's all
squirt
good.
Cheese. Yum.
Well, thanks for joining us, James.
Thanks, guys.
So we're here with Gary Glass. He's the director of the American Homebrewers Association. Welcome, Gary. What brings you to the World Brewers Forum?
We're a sponsor of the World Brewers Forum. We have been for many years now, so definitely something that we feel is worthwhile in supporting. They always have great speakers here and an awesome gathering of not only homebrewers, but professional brewers are always in attendance. So it's a great event, and we're proud to support it.
Have you had any homebrews that they've been pouring?
Yes, I have.
Anyone striking in particular?
The Creek that was made with
the
tainted wood chips that Vinny Chilurzo provided from his talk here in Denver at the National Homebrewers Conference.
I have a bag of those in my basement. I'm scared to use them.
I have a bag in my basement as well. We're like right next to my brewing area, so I'm a little nervous about it too, but I haven't had any problems so far. But I've got to find something to use them for.
Vinny's got a funny story. When he goes to the wine country, they kind of make him walk in with a spacesuit so he doesn't contaminate their vineyards, you know, with the Brettanomyces.
He's a walking
season.
Brat.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Very nice.
So how's the American Homebrewers Association, the membership and all that going?
Membership is great. We're at the highest level we've had in about a decade. We've got almost 18,000 members now. We've seen some pretty phenomenal growth over the last few years. Homebrewing in the United States is growing. So we'd like to take at least a little bit of credit in terms of the education we do. Certainly the podcasts and the amount of information that's out there is really helping homebrewers get into the hobby and to succeed at it.
A lot of people are complaining that it's harder and harder to win competitions now because they feel that podcasting has actually increased the level of expertise that different people have, not ours.
Well, yeah,
others.
I was gonna say.
Not us.
Well, no, I was going to ask, and awareness is one thing, education, but what do you think about palate and wanting more and better taste and just the desire for something other than mainstream? Where people are going to, you know, it used to be if you wanted to have something better than what you got handed down to you, you'd go learn, make your own bread, your own meatloaf, what have you. Do you think any of there's like a revival of do-it-yourself?
Oh yeah, absolutely, and it's not just in making beer. It's in making cheese at home and making your own sausage. It's throughout the country, and I mean I think it's just kind of another aspect of the movement to do things locally, using less petroleum products in transporting things, and so you're buying from your local farmer's market, making it at home is as local as you can get. So. Mm-hmm. I think it's a kind of a natural thing for people to be that are conscious about what they're eating and drinking, and wanting to do things locally to get into homebrewing. It makes complete sense.
These two guys right here got me into homebrewing, and I guess I've been homebrewing right at a year or a little over a year, and really enjoying it. And of course, started out in extract, and now branched off into all grains. Went back and made a couple of extracts, and now I realize I want to stay in all grain. But you said cheeses, and that's something I've been reading up on the last couple of weeks, and I think I'm getting ready to go out and get a cheese kit.
Oh yeah, yeah, I definitely recommend it. I've made some cheeses at home. So the softer cheeses are really easy to do. Mm-hmm. Haven't gotten into the high end like hard cheeses, to make a really high quality Chev. Is very easy,
really?
And it's just a matter of a few days,
and fairly inexpensive
very
too.
Goat smoke is fairly pricey, but relative to what you would pay for, something that's comparable in quality, you'd be paying like probably four times what you can do.
Right.
For
get a good beer and some good cheese.
Yeah, what goes better with a good beer than cheese?
Exactly.
And to cook with and everything, all goes together.
I was reading, and I can't remember which of the beer magazines I was reading, but it was talking about a competition back in mid to late 80s and the minimum number of styles at the work compared to today. So styles have gone just like through the roof. And if you look at it, some of them, and I've read about some of the American styles, the Imperials, the Doubles and things, that's the American influence on beer versus way back when it was all classic. Let's brew like the Germans, let's brew like the Belgians. So looking at where it was, where it is, where do you think we'll see going into the future?
I think right now, for example, there's a lot of challenges for homebrewers in terms of access to hops. So a lot of people who might have been brewing imperial hops, it's a lot more expensive to do, and throwing hops in the mash and throwing hops in like every minute of the way through like some commercial breweries do, it's not really as economically viable as it used to be. And so I think what we're going to be seeing. And what we're already seeing in competitions is styles like Scottish ales, going back to those lower gravity things. And I think there's also a little more consciousness of the effects of alcohol,
you can only drink so many Imperial IPAs.
Yeah,
right. And you certainly can't drink a few of them and get in your car and drive. That would be that would be irresponsible. But, you know, if you're like me, I like to drink a few. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if I'm going to drink a few, I'm not drinking Imperial IPAs. I want something that's flavorful,
yep,
but lower in alcohol. And I think that's probably where we're going to see a lot more creativity in terms,
yeah,
of what you can do with lower gravity beers.
Yeah, we when we came from the GABF, one of the beers I had, and I forget the brewer, but it was a sour wheat. It was 3.1% alcohol, mm-hmm, like nothing. But it was like, it just like was one of the face twisters.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was really just a lot of twang and a lot of taste. It was like really interesting. So, yeah, I think it's something that, barring the hop shortage, such as it is, but from what we've read, that's going to go away.
Well, they have planted more, and the crops are coming
crops
back.
Are coming.
But, you know, it's going to be one of those waveform type things where it, you know, goes extreme to one end to the other and back and forth until it kind of balances out.
But it might inspire some creativity.
And ultimately, we'll end up paying more for our hops.
Yeah.
Well,
will be the
something
end
else, too. We our paper had a segment on a guy in Memphis that was a home brewer, and he's growing his own hops. So I would imagine there's a lot of home brewers growing their own hops.
Very popular this year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've actually been interviewed by several newspapers around the country wanting to do stories about local homebrewers that are now not only brewing at home but growing their own hops.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that one of the major suppliers for Hop Rhizome said that they had sold out faster than they ever have this past year.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think they'll probably sell even faster this year.
So in 2 or 3 years, those people should be getting real good bumper crops.
Right,
you know.
Sure.
But the same with commercial. So hopefully it was just a hiccup in the supply and demand. And
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it will stabilize, but it's not likely to go down in price very much over the next few years. It might go down a little bit, but it'll never go down to what – I mean, it's
kind of like gasoline.
Once they start getting a certain amount,
it won't come down.
All right. So you think we're up so hard
what had happened was that there was an oversupply in the market, and the large breweries that can really control the market were able to force the prices lower than what was really affordable for farmers to plant the hops, and so they were planting less and less hops because it just wasn't very economical for them. They could plant something else and earn more off of that land than they could with hops, and so you're seeing a decline in the amount of hops that were being planted at the same time as the world market for beer was going up, we had kind of the perfect storm at the end of 2007, where we'd had a small 2006 crop, small 2007 crop, and several issues with fires at warehouses and poor weather that really caused the whole crisis. But
forget about the ethanol craze. Everybody going to corn. All these farmers starting to plant corn instead of hops. And
that actually is more affecting barley prices, because you don't grow corn in the same place as you grow hops. You don't grow corn in the same place as you grow barley either, but corn is a feed grain.
Uh-huh.
And so the price of feed goes up, and barley is also a feed grain.
Okay. Now, what do you think about some of the major brewers rolling out their ales? And, I mean, is that an indicator of more preference for taste and quality and richness, depth of flavor versus your dad's...
This is what's known in the industry as a softball. The perfect answer is yes.
Go ahead
and hit it out of the park.
I'm setting it up. You got to spike it.
Well, imitation is, the finest form of flattery.
Amen.
I think the one issue for small breweries when the major breweries come out with these beers is that... those breweries have no problem getting access to shelf space.
Yeah.
And that is the big issue for small craft breweries, is when a major brewery comes out with one of these new ales that, for them it's a drop in the bucket. It's never going to be a major moneymaker for them. But what it does is it'll take up shelf space that would otherwise be going to a small brewery. Mm-hmm. And so when those brands expand, they're taking the place of other small breweries and taking money out of your local brewery. So that's kind of where I see that. I have no problem with there being more good beer out there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's a good thing. But I think it is kind of important for people to be aware of what happens when those beers start showing up in your liquor store, because there's only so much shelf space, mm-hmm. and they have the distribution power to make sure that they're on the shelf.
I went to a restaurant in Baton Rouge the other night, and they had the American Ale on tap. Well, that tap took somebody else's place, mm-hmm. and you're exactly right. That's what they're doing, is flooding the market and trying to create, just a flood of their beers to eliminate people from drinking other beers.
Well, it's a lot easier. You got brand recognition.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, yeah, it's taking shelf space, but on the other, I'm looking at it as more positive, raising awareness.
Exactly. It's a gateway thing. It's going to bring more people into the craft beers.
Yeah, so. I mean, absolutely. That is true. I mean, mm-hmm. for those people who, because you're not going to see a whole lot of people who are loyal to their local breweries, and that know really, really good quality beer. They're probably not going to be tending to buy those major brewery craft knockoffs regularly. And we might pick up a six pack to try it out, but I don't think that they're going to be found regularly in the refrigerators of those people who are supporting their local craft.
Let's also admit that during the early days of craft beer brewing, not everybody was doing a very good job at it.
So,
a lot of people have gone out to a brew pub that was maybe a national chain brew pub. The brewer didn't know what the hell they were doing, and beer's a little too sweet, a little too sticky, or a little too over hoppy. Maybe it tasted like butterscotch, and they got totally turned off.
But there you go. You talk about not doing a good job. I mean, look at the BL, the Bud Lime, and all these different beers they keep coming out
them.
With.
Come on, bring them out.
But
yeah.
what I'm getting at, a lot of these beers they come out with, and I have not tried the American Ale yet. I don't know what it tastes like.
No, I haven't either.
But I know the Bud Lime is not up my alley. And
it's a wonderful lime-flavored malt beverage.
Yes, and many of their other beverages I do not care for, and I know a lot of my friends don't care for
them
either.
Great American Beer Festival is a wonderful opportunity for us to get out there and try these beers.
Yes. So. Well, that's like the smoked beers that Rick and I were liking. Yeah. You didn't care for
I
that.
Did find one I liked.
We're bringing them along for the Ralph beer.
The diversity of taste, though, and this is a...
Well, Gary, I like the sour beers, too.
Let's go ahead and wrap up
the
segment.
Sour beers.
Gary, thank you for joining us, and we greatly appreciate it.
So. Oh, certainly. My pleasure.
And we're going to bring more people into the hobby as much as we can, because we love it.
Absolutely. A big part of my job, so I'm happy to continue that trend.
Okay. We appreciate it.
We're happy to continue. Thank you.
Oh, Black Betty, bam a lamb. Whoa, Black Betty, bam a lamb. She really gets me high, bam a lamb. You know that.
We're joined by Randy Mosher, and you're here at the World Brewers Forum, and your book, Radical Brewing,
right.
And then you're promoting a new book on tasting beers. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it's called Tasting Beer. It will be out at the end of February, published by Story Publications. It's about 250 pages. I think of it as a master class in beer geekery. It's really everything you need to know to really appreciate beer, get the most out of every glass of beer that you drink. So it's a little bit about sensory and how your nose works and how your tongue works and how all that stuff's connected to your brain, which is really important in the tasting process, and how to use that information to recall memories and pull out aromas and really put your finger on all that stuff that we all taste in a beer, but really to be able to be specific about the individual components. Mm-hmm. It's really important when you're trying to evaluate beer, or to really just appreciate beer, and you want to get every little tiny bit out of it and get that all that information that every glass of beer has. You want to understand that.
I'm getting started with helping out judging, and there are a lot of competitions and more
right.
coming up. It's difficult to describe what you're tasting.
That's the challenge for everybody, is to come up with that vocabulary.
Everyone has a little bit of a different palate. They're tasting more or less of one component.
Right.
I had a professional brewer say, I can't taste diacetyl.
Yeah,
so you guys are going to have to let me know if this beer has that buttery taste.
We had one on a flight today. 20% of people are blind to certain types of chemicals, and as a judge, as a taster, it's really helpful to know that.
Now, the book, though, that you write, and so Rick is coming at it from a judge perspective.
Sure.
Who would you say your audience is for the book? Because if it was someone who's never really tried beers, and typically when they taste something that's got a little more pronounced flavor or actually just having some flavor, they come back, oh, it's too bitter, it's too this, it's too that. And how do you go and invite somebody into this diverse world of flavors and tastes? Exactly what you just, you know, what's coming into you, how do you process that? I mean, it's easier for somebody who's had a lot of experience, but what about for people who haven't? Will they benefit from reading your book?
Well, I think they will, but now you're talking about people's frame of mind, and that's the most difficult thing to get at. You know, I like to think about that I'm doing it with trickery and cajolery. You know, that I'm telling stories and getting people to get intrigued in the ideas of beers and the stories of beers and the histories of beers. And then once you find out those histories, the flavors make more sense. Mm-hmm. You know, that all kind of comes together in a way that's not always apparent just from the beer in the glass. When you taste, I mean, a really good taster can actually taste that glass and they could reconstruct a recipe for you. You know, this is 60 Lovibond Crystal right here, bang, bang. My wife can do that. She doesn't know anything about brewing, but she knows that flavor of red ale. She just hates it. It's 60 Lovibond Crystal, right?
That's maybe hating is the secret. Knows. Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
one thing she knows. But if you taste beer critically, you can really, you can go the yeast, you can tell what fermentation temperature, you can tell an awful lot. And that's just fun as a hobby to be able to do that.
Sure.
Not everybody needs to drink beer that way, but this is a book about tasting, not drinking.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
I can taste extract beers. I swear I can.
Yeah.
I may not be able to. Maybe I'm fooled. But
right.
What am I tasting? It tastes kind of like tin.
Yeah, we used to, the brewer, one of the brewers, and commercial brewers in Chicago used to refer to that as ballpoint pen aroma.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
You know that smell of ballpoint pen ink? And it's like, that's what it tastes like.
Yeah.
That's what it smells like. I'm not exactly sure, but we all kind of think it's probably some sort of an oxidation product or a browning product. Malt extract has the right moisture content to actually undergo the same kind of browning that occurs during malt kilning, because it has a high amount of moisture, a high concentration of sugars and amino acids together, and under those conditions that stuff actually gets darker over time, and that darkening causes flavor changes. So freshness is really everything with malt extract. Mm-hmm. Which one reason dry is better, or if your homebrew shop carries a bulk extract that they sell a lot of, that's usually the way to go.
So you would recommend a dry malt extract over a liquid malt extract?
Unless you're buying bulk
grain.
Extract from a place that you know sells a lot. You know, always ask your shop because they are the guys that know. But it's, you know, that's some sort of either an oxidation or this browning reaction. Not exactly clear which, but something along that. But there is a taste, a fresh extract, well-brewed beer with some additional grains such as crystal malt or something thrown in. It's very hard to tell the difference between that and an all-grain recipe.
Yeah, I think maybe overly oxidized beer and an extract beer kind of have similar characteristics. But
the oxidation covers a huge amount of territory in terms of flavor, and so...
Right.
Yeah, they all share common things, but there's a lot of different forms of that. Some of them are actually appealing. You get an aged beer, they start to get that kind of a saddle leather quality, you know, and that's an oxidation kind of thing.
Or almost sherry.
Right. That's oxidation, but there's a lot, again, lots of different forms of oxidation, lots of different chemicals that can become oxidized and give flavors to
you. Well, you need the alcohol and the malt body to carry that level of oxidation for many years.
And I was
going to
have said about the alcohol, when you start getting into the bigger beers, where you've got, on paper, a much higher IBU, yet the taste isn't quite as hoppy as something that's a lower alcohol beer, but still, you know, balance-wise, a little higher IBU.
Yeah, absolutely. Ray Daniels talks about BU to GU, basically bitterness units to gravity units, and so you're looking at a beer like a Guinness Draft Stout, for example. That has extraordinarily high bitterness to gravity ratio because the beer is not very strong, but it's about 45 IBUs, which is a considerable amount of bitterness.
Right.
Take 45 IBUs and you put it in a Doppelbock and you barely notice it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it really is all a matter of balance and relativity. Mm-hmm. So
I mean, we had a beer earlier, 99 IBUs. Could have been a palate killer, but it was such an imperial that it's like, it just kind of flowed right on by. And it's,
well, and to be perfectly honest, brewing science says that all those IBU analyses may not be quite what they're, you know, it's a little bit of an open question, because even if that beer had been analyzed in 99, the analysis doesn't necessarily, well, it's too complicated to go into here, but but it's a more complex than it might appear on the surface.
Well, the IBUs came up, our local newspaper printed an article that our distributor had kind of gotten placed. It was, I forget what the holiday was, but they did a feature like, here's about beers. Once again, let us tell you about beers. And some of the people I know who really weren't beer drinkers hung their hat on that IBU. It's like, there's a gauge. There's a gauge I can tell. Oh, that's a bitter beer.
And right, I like a 35, but not a 40.
Yeah, and it's like, no.
No, you can't do that.
It's just a number. It's a number, and depending on what's behind it, like you said, the BUs versus
the balance.
It's like horsepower in a car. Right. Get a 2,000-pound car with 100 horsepower, that's pretty zippy. But you put that in a 5,000-pound car, and you ain't going anywhere.
Right.
So it's the same idea. It's all relative. Mm-hmm.
That's a good analogy about the horsepower.
Yeah. So I do like that.
We have a giant car driving a big old beer.
That's right.
If you got 40 IBUs in water, okay, it's going to taste pretty bitter.
Well, you can make that. I mean, we do at the Siebel Institute, we have little chemicals that we can squirt in. Sometimes we do a 30 IBU Budweiser.
Interesting.
Yeah. Does it make it drinkable?
Yeah.
Don't answer. I know that's a loaded question.
It makes it hoppier, so you can judge yourself, but it changes it.
Well, we appreciate your time, and I'm going to buy this book because I am desperately looking for better ways to describe beers. Some people are very eloquent about it, and they've got huge vocabularies, and they can taste minute details even if they're making them up.
It really is an art unto itself for a while.
Some people say, I'm tasting this style, so I'm tasting these 35 flavors, and here's what I actually taste.
We had a cheat sheet with all of these vocabulary words that we would look at and say, okay, it tastes like that
horse
one
blanket.
And that horse blanket.
One cool trick before we go. Your olfactory sense, your sense of smell, is wired into some really weird, old, primitive parts of your brain. Like the hippocampus, which regulates memory, right? That seems like pretty geeky, useless information until you realize you taste a flavor and you have these immediate, vivid memory flashbacks.
Yeah.
Right? So you can use those as a taster. You can say, oh, grandma's house. All right.
Musty.
There you go. Maybe it's musty. My grandpa's basement had a certain smell, and I smell that certain. Yeah. But maybe it's cookies. Maybe it's flowers.
Right,
maybe it's
sachet.
So
it's an association.
And so if you can walk around in those memories a little bit, linger there, and think about where you are and what you have, sometimes you can often come up with, oh, roses or whatever it is. And that's startling. That's really fun.
Yeah.
And when you got brewers who know how to mess with you using those little memory things, you've got a brewer who really understands
beer. Yeah.
Right.
It's fun listening to people drink a beer, and they go, oh, wow, that's way too alcohol, you know, and we sip it, and we don't taste the alcohol, or they find a flavor that they taste.
We're professional
and we don't,
beer
get
drinkers,
it.
Though.
Yeah. Huh?
Well, Mike, we're professional
but
beer
still,
drinkers.
Though, we get into some of the more complex beers, and three people drinking the exact same beer, wildly different tastes. We've had it happen more than once. You get alcohol, I get sweet, he gets hops. It's just it just wrenches, and that's of course
all bring our experience to the table. Yeah. That's the way it is, you know. Yeah.
Okay, so the new book is Tasting Beers.
Tasting Beer. It's published by Story Publication. It's going to be about 250 pages, about $17. It's going to be a great deal, and should be out around March 1st.
March 1st.
Okay. Are you able to get it like Amazon stuff like that?
I think it's on pre-sale at Amazon right now.
Excellent.
Okay, good. What I heard. Right. I haven't.
Are you going
it,
through the Brewers Association with this one, or
no? This is a company called Story Publications, division of Workman.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look for it. Thank you for your time.
Thanks,
appreciate
Randy.
It.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. We're joined here with Tony Simmons, president and head brewer from Pagosa Brewing Company, Pagosa Springs, Colorado. And, wow, there's a lot of competition in Colorado. How's that going?
Well, for us, it's going great. We're the local hometown mountain brewery for Pagosa Springs. Just for reference, Pagosa Springs is down in the Four Corners, just on the other side of Wolf Creek Pass. If you're coming from Denver, we're just east of Durango. We're ski resort town. We have beautiful skiing at Wolf Creek. We have hot springs, and we now have a brewery. So we're the only brewery in a probably 40-mile or more radius.
How old is the brewery?
Pagos Brewing is just coming up to its two-year anniversary this November.
What's your proximity to Durango?
We're an hour east of Durango.
Okay.
Where Durango's got four breweries, we've got ours.
Yeah, I think they got four breweries like in one block, right?
Durango's not that big a town, so they're all pretty close to each other. They're pretty close proximity to each other.
Well, what's your background? What'd you do before the 2 years that you're doing now?
Well, let's see here. Before I got into beer, well, I've been fascinated with homebrewing since I was in high school. I tried fermenting cider in my locker and almost got thrown out. And thank goodness things didn't get worse from there.
That's a good story, actually.
Yeah. It is a good story. I like that one. But, I lived in Pagosa for a lot of years. I mean, I drove into Pagosa a dozen years ago, and I said, we have a grocery store, we got a movie theater, where's the brewery?
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, I made the brewery happen.
Awesome.
But I've really become a beer evangelist, if you will, for our community because they didn't know anything about craft brew. I mean, we can get some bottle beers in. There's some liquor stores. They had a couple of taps, but nothing really radical. There was never a Belgian yeast strain that was ever in our county. Right now we've been enormously successful. We have 14 beers on tap. We're served at four different restaurants, five different liquor stores. We sell our growlers at liquor stores. We're up 71% from a year ago.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's going great. We just bought a new kitchen yesterday. We're tearing out the old kitchen to put in a new dining area, and we're buying the property next door, adjacent lot, so we can get guaranteed parking, guaranteed lighted signage, and access to the main boulevard. So things are going great for us.
So over the 2 years, you've grown obviously a tremendous growth, but you said you had to be an evangelist to the community. So when you come in, how do you go about evangelizing? You've got all these people who, of course, we are in Colorado, so there's not a wasteland.
You aren't in Mississippi,
is what
he's trying to say.
There's a couple of good beers around here.
Colorado is a very beer-friendly state. And a lot of people have come here, have really come to appreciate that. In our town, nobody had ever had an IPA. Some people still to this day have no idea what an IPA is. So I'm becoming a beer evangelist in sharing styles with people. We're also really community-based, so we help out charities and nonprofits, and you're really involved with our Chamber of Commerce daily. And we're really involved with our community, and our community really supports us. And, we'll do a taster tray of 12 to 14 beers, and people are blown away. They have no idea. The comment I usually get is, wow, there's a lot of beer here, and gosh, I didn't know there was so many colors of beer.
Yeah.
Because we really strive to have every beer have a different place on the wheel.
Most people think there's only two colors, dark and light.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So in this case, when they're like, they didn't know there was so many colors of amber or blonde going into the dark. So, people who always thought that dark beer was too bitter or IPA was way over the top or what's that stinky Belgian stuff, have suddenly become real fans of some of our beers. One that really took off recently was our coconut porter. We won a gold medal at the North American Beer Awards, number one specialty beer in all of North America. We were very honored about that. It was going to be a one-time, beer for a special party, and we've had to brew it throughout the entire summer. We finally had to pull the plug on it because we had so many other beers in the docket, because I really believe it's so important to give people choice. Like I said, we have 14 beers on tap, and people come to our brewery and said, I've never seen this many beers on tap at a brew pub. How do you do this? And I tell them it's just madness. So it's what I love to do, and showing people what's available out there.
What size is your brewery?
We can squeeze out 6.1 barrels on our brew house.
How about your fermenters?
I have six to seven barrel fermenters, and then two doubles.
Four, six to sevens. Okay.
Yeah, we have
two batches per. Fermenter.
We have four single batch fermenters and two doubles. That's a better way to say it.
Okay. So you're busy brewing.
You're busy. The saving grace is we have 10 serving tanks.
How many mainstay beers do you have versus experiments?
I would look at it this way. We have, for instance, we have real lovers of our cream ale. Mm-hmm. We have real lovers of our IPA and our award-winning Poor Richard's Ale. And those are on all year long. Then a lot of other ales, beers rotate in and out. So, for instance, half the year we'll do a red ale, and the other half the year we'll do an ESB. We'll do a light wheat in the summer and a Dunkelweizen in the winter. The stout's on almost all the year. Just sometimes in the summer, we rotate it out just to put in a specialty beer, just because the summer just moves a little slow. And we're really trying to maximize what we can do. So I would say, you know, there's probably like a good 5 to 7, you know, mainstay beers. Like I said, some rotate seasonally, but they're on for, you know, 6 months out of the year.
So you cover a lot of the styles, a lot of different styles. Is there any style that you have a fondness for or lean towards more?
Oh, a favorite style, usually the one that's in my hand. But
agreed.
You know,
always the right answer.
I would look at it this way. You know, sour ales are not my specialty, and fruit beers are not my specialty. I can appreciate them, and sour beers more from afar because they just don't agree with my stomach. I'll end up with a bit of a churn in the stomach on sour beers. But not to say that they aren't well made. I can appreciate a well-made sour beer. And I've been talking to New Belgium, for instance. They're pushing the sour beer program where I can run a couple of their sour beers. But right now, it's more important to have our beers on tap. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, our town is a tourist-based economy. And to draw people to our community because of our beer is a real honor for me. And that's what we strive to do. You know, here at the GABF, you know, I brought a big crew up. And one of my crew is the director of our Chamber of Commerce. She's actually right now pouring our beer at the GABF.
Awesome.
Yeah. And she's blown
getting
away.
An honest day's work out of it. That's good.
Good. She's good for you.
Job.
Yeah.
Great job. You know, yeah. And she's passing out brochures, and she loves it. I mean, people are excited. It's another excuse to come down to Pagosa, and that's her job.
Yeah.
So what's the bigger sales, your kegs or your growlers?
Growler sales are enormous. We've really pushed the green factor at the brewery. You know, we buy green power from our electric cooperative. We have compact fluorescence wherever we are. We really strive to we try to reuse our water whenever possible. Mm-hmm. But the growlers are key because, you know, it doesn't go into the recycling stream.
Right.
You know, they get rewashed at the brewery, and it's an enormous saving of resource. I mean, it's absurd to think you take your dishes, your dinner dishes, and rather than rewashing them, you break them on the ground and send them off and go buy new dishes the next day. I mean, and that's... I hate to say it, but that's what 12-ounce bottles are.
Yeah.
Well, I would think also the growlers are going to help you engage the community, too.
It's
you
very
get
true.
This nice jug that I can go
have
label beer
on it
put
with your name
in.
And all that. And that's good advertising.
And a map on it, and I have a great relationship with our liquor stores, and they'll even say, people walk in, what's the local beer? Oh, my gosh, you have to have that Poor Richard's. Tony won this award on it. It's absolutely amazing. And as they bring the purchase to the counter, they'll say, and there's a map on the bottle here so you know how to get to the brewery because you'll get a cheaper refill if you take it there yourself.
Wow.
I'm like, the liquor store? Wow, thanks, guys.
Sweet.
And you kind of have to plan ahead when you're having a growler. It's like maybe I'll have some friends over, you know, or I'm going to have it over a 3-day period, whatever, because you don't want it to go bad.
Yeah.
So what we should talk about tonight at the World Brewers Forum? The synopsis. We don't need it.
World Brewers Forum, my topic was going pro, and I thought it was very important for people to – a lot of people approach me about this. A lot of homebrewers, it's their dream, and it should be their dream. It's a wonderful opportunity, but it's your once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to open your brewery the first time.
Right.
And I thought people should go into it with their eyes wide open and not eyes wide shut. And a couple of people after the presentation approached me and said, thank you for that. I'm actually not going to do a brewery any longer.
Thanks for talking me off the ledge.
And then two other people approached me and said, oh, my gosh, you've really inspired me. I really want to go forward now. And
this is funny because I spent a lot of time thinking about what I'm going to do if I win the lottery. And I've always thought that I'd open up a rib joint and a brewery. And I'm thinking, you know what? I would hire a head brewer and just do my little 5, 10, 20-gallon batches.
And part of my
and just stay in that end.
Yeah.
You
part
know?
Of my presentation was, you know, it's... I know a lot of brewers who brew very aggressively. They brew every weekend, and they're really proud of it, and they make great beer. But if, you know, a family issue comes up, somebody gets sick, and they don't brew on a Saturday, it's not a big deal. For us, you know, we are a factory.
You got to brew.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We want to get you.
No, no problem.
Hey, thank you for your time, and we appreciate you. And we're joined with Greg Hook and James.
James Watt.
Brewdog in Scotland, correct?
Yes.
And Greg from Stone said, we got to talk to James before he gets thrown under the jail or something because all this craziness you're doing now. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, it's fantastic to be here with Dave from Stone. I mean, as a company, we've just been making beer in Scotland for 18 months now, and Stone was one of the companies that kind of inspired us to start up and the kind of styles of beer that they make and how they make them. We just kind of completely inspired by, so it's a huge honour for me to kind of be here with him just now. Yeah, I mean, we've had some issues with the UK. I mean, the UK craft beer scene is kind of so far behind what's happening in the US. I mean, there's you get the kind of yellow, fizzy, mass-made, industrially brewed kind of nonsense. And there's a few small beer companies, but they can all make the same kind of beers. It's all 4%. It's quite boring. And the kind of packaging and marketing is all kind of quite old-fashioned and stuffy and traditional.
They've got their standard, right?
Yeah.
That they've done for year after year after year.
I mean, it's the same now as it was in the 1920s, as it was in the 1820s.
And also in the pub scene's dropped down, too, the consumption at the pubs.
I mean, the smoking bans kind of kicked in, and that's hit them quite hard. And then
DUI laws. Binge drinking laws and all those.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit different in the UK. So what we wanted to do when we started up, I mean, we wanted to take beer styles that we were passionate about, give them a kind of innovative contemporary twist, but then use the kind of market and the packaging of them to take them towards a new sector of the marketplace. So make it not something that's going to put your grandparents to sleep, but make it something that's kind of quite edgy and quite cool. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're two young guys. Myself and Martin was 24 when we started. So we wanted to take these beers and make them to appeal to people our age, kind of young people, and just do something a bit cool with them. In the UK, they've got this body called the Portman Group. It's actually funded by the big players. So it's funded by Heineken, Diageo, all these guys. And they're there to kind of police packaging, marketing, and this kind of thing. So we've had a few problems. I mean, one of our beers, it's an 8% stout. And on the label, it said it's a Twisted Merciless Stout. Apparently, that's going to encourage antisocial behavior. It's just about being blacklisted.
Oh, no.
We made a beer that was called Tokyo that was 12%.
That's much different from Stone's Bad image, you know, arrogant bastard, and you're not worthy. And, you
right. Know, yeah, we're not antisocial in any way.
Not at
right,
all.
Exactly.
So we made a beer that was 12%, which was the strongest beer in Scotland at the time, and we just got absolutely hammered by alcohol aware dupes. I mean, I had to do a few TV interviews. We got so much bad publicity, and I just feel like telling these people, well, whiskey comes from Scotland, that's 40%. I mean, it's just this kind of attitude and mindset about beer in the UK. It's kind of so far behind what it is here. So, I mean, we're working hard to kind of educate people and introduce them this kind of beer, but I can mark how far we've got to go in kind of educating people in the UK. I was doing a tasting a few weeks ago, and we've got a punk IPA, 6% IPA, quite heavily hopped, and the guy was kind of just, he drinks kind of mass-made rubbish lagers, and I kind of gave him the beer, and he tasted it, and he looked at me and put the glass down and walked away, and as he was walking away, he shook his head and says, I don't like any beer that's got hops in it. So it just kind of shows you the kind of attitudes of a lot of people in the UK, but it's something we're working hard to fix, and
we've had
having
some
a bit of fun with it.
Interesting experience with Belgian IPAs, almost a funky taste. What hops are you using in particular?
Yeah. And we tend to use a lot of New Zealand hops. I mean, we want to make kind of beers and flavour profiles. It's a bit different. I mean, we love the US IPAs and what they've got on, but I mean, we don't want to kind of copy other people's beers. We want to make styles that are kind of pretty unique and kind of treat us. So we use some English hops, some European hops, but we focus quite a lot on the kind of cool New Zealand hops. So we use Nelson Sauvin, Motueka, Pacific Gem, that kind of thing. And
have some not got a lot of the Kent Goldings and the
a bit sleepy.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
exactly.
When you say you got the guy that tried it and walked away and didn't like it, what's the overall?
I mean, overall it's good. I mean, there's some kind of beer fans in the UK, but I mean, there's not nearly so big a kind of craft beer scene and not nearly so much people, so it's always fantastic to come out to the US and walk into a bottle shop and just see this kind of fantastic selection of beers and see how passionate and enthusiastic people get about these beers that we love making. So I'm going to hopefully just kind of keep plugging away in the UK and do enough tastings and expose enough people to it and kind of keep getting our message out there and hopefully kind of get the kind of same appreciation level.
I think there's a fair market for imports. We're huge fans of Orkney's Skull Splitter.
Cool.
I don't know if that is competition to you or
mentioning the
friendly or
Splitter, that's another beer that has been pulled up by the Portman Group in the last few weeks because apparently the name's going to encourage violence.
Uh-huh. You're kidding. Skull Splitter.
The funny thing about
really with that
on the back of the beer that the guy that makes it said he recommends drinking it whilst eating patty. So I don't know if they can have people that drink a beer and eat patty at the same time as the guys. It's going to be too violent, but just shows you how kind of little understanding the Portman Group has of the industry.
Those patty eaters are
you gotta watch.
Ruffian group.
That's a shame because that's such a wonderful smoky
it's
Scottish ale. You know, it's just one of the best. We love that.
We were talking earlier though about how the beers and the evolution of beers and where some of the American influences have taken some of the classic more staid styles and taken them to a next level. And of course, Greg's one of the leaders of this with let's see what all we can jam into and let's see how we can wreck your palate and trash you up and make it just worthless for anything else. And now it sounds like it's now gone almost full circle back across the pond, and you guys are coming back and coming out with a little more aggressive behavior, and, you know, you probably should be pulled. But that's okay. We encourage that sort of behavior.
Please choose a different word, if you don't mind. That could get us in trouble.
No, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's really nice to see this kind of evolution, and that's what we were talking about. Like, if you were to go years back in the number of styles at the GABF, yeah, it's far fewer than now, and the diversity is just off the scale. And it's nice to see from an international perspective. It's getting out there, too.
Speaking of Greg, yeah, I have to commend you on your chocolate bittersweet.
Oh, yeah. The Stone 12th Anniversary Bitter Chocolate Oatmeal Stout.
Fantastic beer, man. Yeah. I drank it, a bottle of it, a bomber by myself, and felt a little guilty about that and went out and bought two more. And
you don't have to feel guilty about that at all.
To make up for the guilt, buy more.
They're fantastic. So you did a really great job with that.
Yeah. And the verticals.
And the man, the verticals are amazing. I had a question in there somewhere, though.
Where'd he get a shirt?
Nah. Well, I'll just...
The vertical shirt.
I just want to jump
in. I heard you talking tonight, and unfortunately I didn't get to hear the whole thing, but you were talking about a little bit about slow food movement.
Mm-hmm.
And buying local and eating local, and I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Honestly, it's something that's really, really important to me. You know, I think a lot of craft brewers understand what goes into the beers and how they're made and what the story is behind them and why there's the authenticity. And of course, they really enjoy the flavor and the diversity and the characters that are available in a really great craft beer. But some of these very same people make really questionable food choices. They're ready to buy and consume commodity crap, frankly. You know,
guilty. I'm guilty.
Yeah, hey, we're all guilty to some degree or another, but there's just like there's this incredible world out there of craft beers for those who are in drinking the industrial fizzy yellow lagers. There's an incredible world of, you know, artisanal cheeses for those who aren't, you know, exposed to it yet. There's, you know, all these great local bakeries versus the Wonder Breads, and there's all these amazing little coffee roasters versus the Folgers, etc. And life and food and drink is so incredibly diverse and authentic these days. People are, the passion is returning to the food system. And we still have the industrial food system, which is ruling the day. But I'll tell you what, we're collectively chinking away at it.
And corn sucrose.
Yeah.
It's a major ingredient for everything.
Yeah, high fructose corn syrup. Yeah.
And in our restaurant, we have 100% ban. We have not one thing. And it's amazing how difficult that can be to have bannered totally, because you have to read a lot of labels and you're like, wow, that Worcestershire, can't buy it anymore.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Just about everything has it in it.
Yeah. But that's come up multiple times during some of the people we've talked today about the appreciation for the depth and complexity of food, beer, wine that's out there. And people, I think, these days are demanding more.
Right.
They're slowly backing away.
I think as a whole, though, the nation is a legion of followers, and we watch it on TV. We see it on TV. Well, that's what we buy.
Maybe that's my problem, because I kicked my TV out 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, you really? Yeah. Wow.
I don't have a TV. I haven't had a TV for 15 years. Yeah. Yep. Stone would not
exist. That's a lot of time you just bought.
Say again?
That's a lot of time you just bought.
Absolutely. You know, I was going to say, Stone would not exist if I owned a TV.
3 to 5 hours a day for most Americans.
It's a killer. And it's not like there's nothing that's of value on TV. There's lots of great things. But, of course, sifting through can be incredibly difficult. And for the week, hey, like me, you know, give me a TV. I'm a slack-jaw idiot.
It would sap your
energy. As most people are.
Right. Well, how many times have you heard it called the idiot box?
Yeah, exactly.
Guarantee it.
So your bistro is doing well, and the kickoff is fine?
Yeah.
The startup and...
Stone Brewing World Bistro and Gardens, where our business is going phenomenally well. It's really kind of cool, again, to see how if you do things the way they're not supposed to be done, and we didn't do them that way just for the sake. I've always had a philosophy of don't be different to be different, be different to be better. And with that in mind, I looked through the food system. I looked through all the possible purveyors. I looked how we were going to get our local veggies or, you know, veggies at all, and, of course, chose local ones, etc., and tried to make decisions that I thought weren't simply different to be different, but they were different. They were better. And it took more work than I ever could have imagined to put all these diverse pieces together, small producers and small growers, etc. but the reward is there. It's worth it. Mm-hmm. And just the wonderful stuff that we are able to use, just bringing in the back of the house, and then that's what we make our food from, is these wonderful ingredients. If you're buying mm-hmm. commodity ingredients, you yeah. can only just get so far. It's like you can't make an award-winning cake from cake mix.
Yeah, true.
Can't get there from here.
Unless you add a whole bunch of fresh ingredients. So I know that you have a distributorship, and who are your rising stars at the moment?
Well, you know, I was just talking to Richard Norgrove from Bear Republic. They're up 71% with
us
this year.
Wow, we love Bear Republic. Wow.
My favorite new one this year is The Brewery.
The Brewery. Yeah. We stopped by Patrick's booth.
And stopped by them, too. Yeah.
Taunted a friend of mine who absolutely loves them. And Dick and I, and Mike sometimes, I guess, get out to California frequently. And we've been just waiting for them to open up their tasting room. Yeah. So there's quite a buzz going on with the brewery.
Those guys. And Patrick is frankly, such a great guy. And then, hey, you know what? If I have ever been involved in anything that inspired something like the guys at BrewDog, then I'm, you know, that's really inspiring back to me. So
right, that would be the softball. James here is BrewDog.
No, well, you know, but it's the fact of the matter, and I mean it sincerely. We distribute their beers too. And I'm not an admirer of theirs because we distribute their beers. I don't, you know, it's the other way around. I actually discovered them when I was traveling through the UK with Mitch, our head brewer, in late March and early April of this year. And we were out there for a special event. We actually went, Mitch had gone earlier with my partner, Steve Wagner, our brewmaster, and brewed a beer at Shepherd Neame. Nice. Stone California Double IPA is what we called it, which was odd because we considered it a single IPA. But the UK, that was like, it was 7%. It was like, whoa.
Americans like adjectives. Yeah. We'll string them together, man. Yeah. We're like the Germans that way.
And it was so funny because James, just a moment ago, gave the story of this person tasting his IPA and setting it down and walking away and saying, I don't like hops. I participated in this event where a lot of the venerable brewers from all over the UK, the old school, and also some new guys, and I brought a lot of beers just in bottles. I brought some Stone Old Guardian Barley Wine. I brought some Double Bastard Ale. I brought some Stone Imperial Russian Stout, some Stone Ruination IPA to share with these guys for this big special event. And these were owners and brewmasters of these breweries. And you know what? I was shocked. They didn't even want to try.
Really?
Wow. How strong is that? 10% is this one. I have to. One guy actually is a brewmaster at this brewery. I don't want to mention the name. He says, I have to play tennis later. Tennis later, an ounce of beer? You don't want it to. Really, I didn't give him a hard time because I was just so flabbergasted.
Yeah.
None of these guys even wanted to taste the beer.
That's shocking.
Is how you get this environment that James was talking about. It's very, very stiff.
James, I say stay with the bad boy attitude, and you know, you're going to appeal to someone. The punk rock scene came out of Great Britain, so I know there are some radical people over there.
There's got to be people clamoring for something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're kind of quite outside the kind of clan as it is in the UK. I mean, the guys that your dad was speaking about now, I mean, they can organize beer festivals and stuff in the UK. They won't even take our beers to their beer festival. So I think they're just a little bit scared that some people's doing something that's not dull and not sleepy and a little bit edgy and a little bit cool. So we kind of have the same issues, and I can really understand where he's coming from.
We have some barriers to break down, I would say.
Yeah,
well, your area is a proud people. And they believe in tradition and that type thing, and they don't venture too far from that path.
No.
You know?
But if it was a Scottish beer, you know, they'll embrace it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Sure.
Just market it correctly, and you're good.
But keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, great stuff.
Well, gentlemen.
It's been fun. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having us on.
Good having you guys.
Cool. I would just say at the end, I mean, your dad was mentioning the Stone Bistro. I was lucky enough to go there in April this year, and it's just fantastic. I mean,
the environment.
Seeing how the beer's made. I mean, if I didn't have a business run in Scotland, I mean, I could just help to go and live there and just eat there every day. It's just amazing. So anybody that's got a chance to go, it's fantastic. So you should head out there.
Thanks,
and of course, the right way to do it, of course, would be to have a BrewDog beer while you're there.
There you go.
Appreciate it. All right,
thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Very much.
Cheers.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks.
We're back.
Don't worry about it. It's just game.
I'm about to ask you a
question.
This is Dana Johnson, and you are a member of Croc, and you coordinate this thing. So how did you feel? This the end of the event. It's midnight. We're winding down. How do you think it went?
I think it went really good. You know, for our 14th annual event, it's getting easier every year to put it on. And we've actually, you know, we're on the map now with the Great American Beer Festival.
You had a lot of talent wandering through.
We did. So. Not only homebrewers, but professional brewers. And
people from the AHA and professional brewers. And,
So I like the marriage of homebrewing and professional brewing because I started out as a homebrewer in 1989, but I went pro in terms of selling products to the brewing industry in 1995. So for the last 12, 13 years, this has been a big part of the Great American Beer Festival for me.
I know you were the guy for who do we contact to get swag and, you know, the giveaways and things like that. And
I noticed looking at the board, the beers that were listed out there, and I thought it was pretty funny that here's on the right side of the board that some of the professionals, there's Arrogant Bastard. On the left side of the board, Arrogant Bastard Clone.
Yeah.
And it was like, you've got mirrors of the same.
Yeah, would Bobbitt call that beer stuck up ish?
But the killer is, you got the two guys who made both room, too.
Exactly.
So that was
pretty nice.
And that's the marriage that I'm talking about.
Exactly.
I'm all about that because I think it's, if you have a love of great beer, this is the place to be.
I was there when Rick brewed that, so that was nice to be able to enjoy these people. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, quite a few beers. Good food. Ran out way too quick.
Yeah.
There's a lot of meat eaters around here.
Meatarians?
They ate their way through who knows how many pounds of meat.
Yeah. We have two carving stations and it goes quick.
Yeah, seriously.
Still plenty of beer left.
Yeah.
That's true. That is the good point.
That's a sign of a good event. The beer hasn't run out yet.
Yeah. Right. Why is your club named that? It's like, well, that was the first time that happened, and our goal is to never let
never
it happen
again. But you got some interesting entries in it. You're drinking the hop chocolate. Mm-hmm. I had the Creek. Mm-hmm. That number 15. Creepy.
You had number 6.
Creek and Critters. Of course, number 6.
Number 6, the Amarillo Ale.
One of my personal favorites.
What a great beer. And Deb, we've got Deb here. You brought a mead. You made a mead. I won't say you brewed a mead.
I made it for the NHC in Cincinnati this summer. And it was kind of based on one of the Cincinnati homebrewers' meads from a few years ago. Instead of using the Atomic Fireballs, I used the Jolly Rancher cinnamon candies because Ranchers are made here in Colorado.
Wow.
Okay,
so what now?
Well, Cincin was the name, so Cincinnati and cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
That makes perfect sense.
Is it still a mead?
I'm seeing synergy.
When you add cinnamon.
It is. Okay. It's more of a methaglin when you add spices to it. It's also got the rooibos tea in it, which I was trying for some of the red, but it really imparted a lot of flavor to it that really complements the cinnamon, I think.
Very nice.
See, we're just dumb beer drinkers, and we're still trying to get our heads around Melomel.
We are so
what the hell's a Melomel? I don't know.
We really are.
What constitutes a mead?
Mead is a honey wine, all the fermentable sugars, instead of coming from grains, are coming from the honey.
Okay, well, when you add other things to the mead,
they're called different things.
Different things.
Yeah. If you add spices, they're called methaglins. If you add apple juice, it's a sizer.
If how about like grape juice?
You add grape juice, it's a piment.
Piment. Okay.
If you add a lot
hops
of
hops and malt, it's a
Braggot.
Braggot.
And if you add some different kinds of other fruits besides apples and grapes, it's a Melomel.
Right.
Neat.
Melomel.
So there's so many different ways to go and. I've become an addict, and now I have 2 dozen carboys in the basement full of different meads.
See, that's what we were talking about. It's like, you know, you have the honey and the water and the yeast and the nutrients. Okay, that's basic, I think, for everything. But then you've got everything else. Yeah. It's like it can be dry. It can be sweet. It can be carbonated. It can be flat.
Yeah, it can be still.
Still, right. I guess that's the word.
The thing is how many different kinds of honey are there. There's so many sources,
right.
So many different kinds of varietal flavors and aromas that each one of them have, and the colors are all different, and it's just amazing how much you can do with just honey itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. An average batch of mead takes 12 months?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a long time to wait. Yeah,
it's a commitment.
It's kind of like wine.
It is. It's higher alcohols in a lot of cases. I've never made anything that's been less than probably 11%. Mm-hmm. I'd say probably nothing less than 12%. Mm. You certainly can make 8% meads. A lot of the commercial ones are in the single-digit strengths, and they will ferment out a little bit sooner and be palatable sooner. But mm-hmm. with the higher alcohols, it just takes a while mm-hmm. to mellow out.
But it's not an overwhelming alcohol taste. The Melomel we had was 25%, and it was.
But you didn't know.
We didn't know, and it. Well, you could listen to the show.
It kind of tastes like. We were kind of
null and void.
It was like soda pop, actually. Oh yeah, but we got really
until it wore off a little.
Well, I made a pie.
We're gonna pause for a commercial break here.
Yeah. I made a pie, and when I went and bought the honey, the guy was telling me he's a grower, and he told me about how honey was antibacterial. Mm-hmm. You could leave it out in the open, and right. it will not spoil. Yep.
Correct.
I had no clue.
It will
crystallize,
many,
though.
Oh, yeah, it'll crystallize. All you got to do is heat it back up, and it'll turn back into honey. Yep. Put it in the microwave and warm it up, and it'll be honey again.
Well, so looking at the event, there's a large cross-section of meads, creeks, beers, just all types, right?
And that's what your average homebrew club brings to you.
Right.
I mean, that's a good argument for joining one.
Yeah, yeah. A huge and wildly diverse. There wasn't like a whole bunch of this type. Did you see anything missing this year that you'd like to have seen or that in years past?
You know, I actually was running around so much that, you know, as a coordinator of the event, I really didn't get to try all the beers. So, but... You know, that's the cornerstone of our club is just diversity. You know, everybody has their own tastes, and we have everything from the English ales to the Belgians and everything in between. I mean,
and some exceptional brewers too. I mean, we've got three pro-ams here today. So.
Rick Bobbitt and Rich Kral, Scott Jackson, Carrie and Kelly Floyd. I mean, we've got some of the best brewers in the country, literally, in our club. And they've kind of ratcheted up everything, and we're in the top, 20 clubs in the country?
Yeah. I forget what the standing was, but it's amazing, point-wise. So.
Yeah.
What? Dick's looking at me. I don't know.
No.
I've always done something wrong. I don't know.
The shock top backing up on me here.
All right, Will Puts.
That was a big... if you would have told me 10, 12 years ago that we would have had Anheuser-Busch sponsoring this thing, I would have told you you were crazy.
Yeah.
That's the
and Stone Brewing Company.
And Stone Brewing Company. That's the way the brewing industry is going these days. They're reaching out to us. We're reaching out to them. And as long as they're making good beer, that's what we're all about.
Well, congratulations on a successful event, and we'll try and get this audio posted fairly shortly. We have some excellent interviews, I think, this time.
Yeah. And that's a testimony to the event itself, the type of people that we're just sitting here and...
Yeah, right. Who can we grab? So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's really all in...
top-notch people.
All in one place. Mm-hmm. Great event. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Well, thank you.
See you guys again next year.
We will.
Hey, all right.
We'll be here. Thanks.
Thanks.
Black Betty, Bam-a-Lam, whoa, Black Betty.